Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a quick look at the front pages first. So the Business Post has budget news. US seed to be cut in €11 billion budget. So the Business Post have a number of little sweeties from the budget here. So increases the weekly welfare rates and pressure mounting that they be higher than the €12 increase in last year's budget. At least one €200 electricity credit. But they are holding off on deciding to repeat the package of three credits until they see the impact of current and pending price cuts by energy providers. Free school books scheme extended to secondary schools. Further reductions to childcare costs, but not the full 25% reduction originally committed to. Cuts to student fees, support in paying for medicines. And also the reversing of the reduction in excise. There's one more of those to come, I think, at the start of next month, which would be 8 cent on a litre of petrol and 6 cent on a litre of diesel. They seem to be looking at postponing that. So we'll talk about all that in a minute. The Sunday Independent Coalition in discussions over asking revenue to collect new media levies. So a new universal media levy that could be cheaper than the TV licence fee and collected by the revenue commissioners is being considered by the coalition as part of a major overhaul of RTE's funding model. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Cabinet wants cuts to RTE pay and staff. So they're saying the Cabinet are demanding a series of hard-hitting reforms from RTE, including an incentivised redundancy scheme for high earners, widespread pay cuts and the sale of all or part of the Montrose campus, ministers told the Irish Mail on Sunday. None of the ministers named, but I'm sure they did tell the Mail on Sunday that day. Sunday Times, Gilligan, I'll never live in Ireland again, is their lead. The Sun on Sunday, Day of Reckoning. So they're saying that Gardaí have built up a file. They want to charge Daniel Kinahan and his brother Christy Jr. in connection with a number of feud-related murders. But obviously they have to get them back from Dubai before they do that. And the Irish Sunday Mirror has a story about Sinead O'Connor, and this is her her ex-husband John Reynolds, who, in fairness to John Reynolds, was a loyal constant in Sinead's life. Their marriage ended a long time ago, but he was always there for her, and he is talking about her today and about organising the funeral and various things. Now, our panel today, Louise Bayliss is the founder of Spark and campaign coordinator at Focus Ireland. Dan O'Brien is a chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs. Sarah Carey is a communications consultant and an Irish Independent columnist. And Louise Byrne is political correspondent at the Irish
Impermanence.
What are some...
Good morning. Was that just me? Was that in my head? Or did the whole country hear that? Okay, something barged into me there. I'm sorry, I had a moment. Okay, so Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror, is where I was before whatever happened there happened. Okay, why don't we start with the front of the Business Post and the budget news and the cutting of the USC. Sarah Carey, you picked this.
Yeah, so I know this would probably be very popular. The USC is a hated tax.
The hated USC, as it has to be called.
Yeah, but I'm worried about getting ourselves into a situation that we were in just before the last crash. And back then, it's not that long ago, but people seem to have forgotten, we became very heavily dependent on construction taxes, and income taxes were reduced. Dan probably would be able to tell us exactly how much they were reduced. And we ended up with this very imbalanced economy. Now we're raking it in from corporation tax, but everybody knows that's unstable and uncertain. And
we have very high income taxes in this country. Anyone,
yeah, but actually that's a good thing.
The average industrial wage are paying half their money in tax.
Brendan, I was at a presentation on Thursday that Louise was at as well about the Tier 2 child benefit, which we're going to be talking about. And Brian Nolan was presenting research funded by Community Foundation Ireland. And it is a good news story. In the OECD, the story for the last 30 years has been about widening inequality across all Western societies, the gap between rich and poor widening and widening. Ireland has bucked the trend, and inequality has narrowed in Ireland the most of every other OECD country. And the way we have done that is through a progressive taxation system where we tax people who are well off and the money is given in cash transfers to the poor.
And the USC is the one tax that people who aren't that well off, everyone gets caught for. So is it not a good idea to bring it down?
But the point is, that is the method by which we have narrowed inequality in the country. So if you care about bucking that Western trend of narrowing the inequality gap, this is how we've done it. And if you start reducing income taxes and you keep relying on those corporation taxes and we lose those in 4, 5, 6, 7 years' time, where are you going to be? Back where we were 10 years ago.
I think they're going to reduce income taxes one way or another. So the question is, do they do it by using the USC or do they do it using bans?
I noticed that about the bans, and I think there's probably a little bit more sense in that, you know, that people are slower to get into that higher band. But the point remains the same. Let's think about the long term here and what are we doing? We have an inflationary society. If you put more cash into that society, you make it more inflationary. I'm just a bit nervous about it, Brendan, that's all.
So Louise, I suppose Sarah's saying a few things about it there, but essentially that this is more narrowing of the tax base. Do you think we should cut the USC?
In theory, actually, no, I don't, Brendan. Not when there's such a dearth of services in the country. I just think that we need to keep our tax base, as Sarah said. One of the things, we were both at the conference, the SRI conference, where they talked about the Tier 2 child benefit. And they spoke about how putting 700 million into doing that would reduce child poverty by 40,000 children.
This currently, I don't understand the sums of that. Did they that's 17 and a half grand a year.
I know,
per
I was
child.
Looking at that, but it's
you
not.
Could, you could totally reduce child poverty if you gave 40,000 children 17 and a
no,
half grand.
No, in fairness, I was looking at that too, and it didn't make sense because I thought if you had three children, that's 54,000 or whatever. So that's not what it's about. It's reducing 40,000 children are going to be lifted out of poverty. There will be another lift for children who are in poverty. They may not go over the poverty line, but they will be lifted by it too.
So that money isn't
it's for the 170,000 children in poverty.
Not happening anyway, is it? The government seemed to say, look, we were doing a lot for child poverty, but we won't do that.
They seem to be saying that perhaps it's worthy of consideration, but what Children's Minister Roger Gorman told us at that conference on Thursday morning was that what the government want to do was they want to look at things that they know work, and they've put, his words, not mine, but they've put money into different kind of childcare schemes and they've seen the benefits for that for people. So perhaps while it's worthy of consideration, I don't think you'll see it in this year's budget, purely because the budget's in 5 weeks' time and something like this will put an awful lot of effort and time to actually put into place.
So it's too hard.
It's too hard right now. It could be an option
it's
down the track.
Hard, isn't it?
Sorry, Brendan, just one more quick one on that.
I'll come back to you, Sarah.
All right.
Dan, it's too hard. It's too hard to target things as well, and it's all too hard. So are these broad brush measures cutting the USC? Is that the way to go?
So we're in full sort of period of time with speculation about what's going to be in the budget. I suppose...
Well, people enjoy it and it impacts on people's lives in a real way, unlike a lot of the things we could be talking about here. So,
Maybe we're here.
I'm sorry if it's too early for you, Dan, but catch up.
As I say, maybe world weariness. But look, a positive thing. This time last year, when you were kind enough to have me onto the show, things were looking really grim. Okay, for Ireland, for Europe, with the energy shortages, the US inflation problem, it looked like we were heading for a very deep recession, or at least there was a very good reason to think that we were going that way. What do we find? Ireland's doing really well. Europe avoided recession. America's maybe growing too strongly at the moment. So it's a very solid position. Should, as Kieran Casey, an economic historian, says today, that by...
He's writing in the Sunday Independent.
He says, stimulating the economy now, which any tax cuts or any spending increases, quote, breaks a fundamental rule of good fiscal policy. Don't add fuel to the fire during a period of high inflation. Mm. Now, we clearly have a period, one of the down bad news parts of the economic situation that we're in is that we still have inflation. There's still too much inflation and it hasn't come down as fast as many of us expected or hoped. And fueling the economy at a time when we've got a clear inflation problem is certainly from an economic perspective.
So hang on, they shouldn't be giving out 200 euro energy credits either, should they?
Some of the measures could actually help bring down inflation. But generally, if you add lots of spending increases and tax cuts together, you're actually going to put more people into money into people's pockets, which will keep the inflationary pressure.
So we're back to can't compensate. People have to feel the pain of inflation, do they?
Well, the argument is that if you compensate everybody for the pressures of inflation, then you're never going to bring down inflation. You're going to have a longer term inflation problem. Better to try and get it down quickly so we can stabilize prices. So that's purely an economic perspective. Like, clear, you know, this could be the last budget before the election. Obviously, politics plays into it, but just giving it from a purely sort of economic perspective, I don't think you'd find many economists who come on here and say, yeah, we should have a stimulatory budget at a time of high inflation and strong growth.
Yeah, and IFAC were very, very strong that Eddie Casey, strident, you'd almost call him if you
were. And rightly so, that's his job.
So come here, Dan, while we've stumbled onto this now, and I'll come back to the others in a minute, but I do want to get your general catch-up views on things. So I'm slightly confused by what you're saying about that everything is roaring along nicely, because I suppose what we've been seeing in the last week or two is headlines like, well, China's off, that's going to impact the rest of us. Growth in Europe is down. We've revised our own growth down, which then on one hand, that's what we want, isn't it? Isn't that the purpose of the interest rates? Then on the other hand, there was a bizarre situation during the week when they gave the new Irish inflation and they said inflation is up. And part of what had put inflation up was the inflationary measures, because mortgage interest was part of what had driven inflation. So the anti-inflation measures are driving inflation. So just give me a bit of clarity on all of this. Is a downturn not what this is all about? That's what we're looking for here. That's
well,
the result?
A cooling, I suppose. In Europe, we clearly
a soft landing.
Still have. And I don't want to use that term given the connotations it has in this country, but certainly international commentary in the US and here is the hope that there will be these. We've had a huge increase in interest rates over the past year or so, and usually that, or very often, it tips countries, economies into recession. Now, the hope is, international commentators or analysts are saying, hopefully we'll have a soft landing. We won't have an increase in unemployment. And another fantastic news story, both here and in Europe and in the US, unemployment is remarkably low. So,
did Eddie Casey say during the week, I think, that we are possibly above full employment? I think he might have said that.
Maybe, and you could analyse it that way, because one of the other quite miraculous
too many jobs
since the pandemic is...
Like, is there a healthy level of 95% employment, kind of, and if you go above it, you're...
Well, we're nowhere near that. So of our adult population that's working, we have about 70% of the adult population. Now, that's the highest on record. It's actually jumped up since the pandemic remarkably. So, you know, by that measure, you could say some countries like the Netherlands, the best performer, they have 80% of working age people working. So if we got up to theirs, that means we still have a lot of people who could come into the labour market. But different countries, different things at different times. So just to come back to where we are, you mentioned China. In my entire life, I have never heard so much bad news coming out of China economically. So for 40 years, there has been a miracle in that country. It's become the second biggest economy in the world. There is just one thing after the other coming out of China. So it very much looks as though this miracle period in China could be ending and they could be going into recession. That will have some consequences, but I don't think it's going to have a material effect on us in Europe.
Okay.
So the China thing is certainly globally is a concern, but I don't think it's going to have a material
European
effect on us.
European growth off, Irish growth revised down.
So Irish growth, European growth, there are some renewed wobbles about fears in Europe. Recession risks have not gone away, certainly in Europe. There's the interest rate effect that's kicking through. It takes time for higher interest rates to come through. Next week, we could well, most economists don't think the European Central Bank will increase interest rates next week. I'm in a minority. I think they will.
But do you think it'll be the last one for now?
That's entirely dependent on the inflation numbers, because the inflation numbers keep, it's like going up a mountain.
Do you not have to leave time, though, for these measures to work as well? Like they underestimated at the time. Are they not in danger now of overdoing it, maybe because they didn't react quickly enough?
They are. But I think they'd prefer to now, having underreacted, they'd prefer now to overreact, because if they underreact again, they feel they've underreacted once at the beginning of this, they've underreacted again in the middle of it. So their credentials as inflation fighters would really be damaged. So they'd almost prefer to underreact once and overreact another time.
So you think
we'll
see another one next week?
I think we will.
Sure.
And what happens in the future, the inflation problem in Europe just is sticking around in a way that I certainly didn't think it would, or I think most economists. Mm-hmm. And as long as it sticks around, there will be pressure on the body that is charged with controlling inflation, that is the ECB in Frankfurt, to keep acting. So I wouldn't put, you know, until the data clearly show that we are not getting prices going up month after month after month after month, as we have been doing for about 18, 24 months, only then will they be able to take the foot off the brake.
Okay. Now, let's, sorry, I'll go back to the rest of the panel now. Louise, you mentioned there a minute ago about we should not be cutting taxes when services are not good enough. And I think you're pointing to a piece in the Sunday Independent by Wayne O'Connor with families of children with special needs and horror stories, really.
Absolute horror stories. And we're not providing the supports to families who are in real difficulties. Now, I represent Spark, which is single parents. The pressure when you have a special needs child to get those services, there's such a waiting list for those services. So, for instance, I was talking to a woman last year and she had no electricity in her house, no food in her house, because her daughter was due to go into school this September, this month, and she knew that her daughter needed an SNA and she hadn't got the assessment. She was on waiting list after waiting list. She did everything she could to get the help. So she funded it privately. When she's on social welfare, she went and got a credit union loan. She couldn't afford the payments, you know, with all the other costs and her electricity.
She got a credit union loan.
She got a credit union loan to pay for the assessments, and that's the type of thing. That's why it's.
There's
you know,
an interesting thing in those stories, and those stories are very hard edged. Now, a woman who can't, because of her quite a young boy, but her and the other children can't really live in the house.
That's it.
So the boy's dad and the grandfather are there to help, and then she goes and visits the boy, I think, in a very careful way. Now, the one thing I think that is common in a lot of these stories is that there are two parents there, and that they are both working hard together to kind of manage a situation. I presume for women on their own with a complicated situation like that, it is
it's impossible because you can't earn the money because you need to be there physically. So you're going to be living in poverty anyway. Your child with special needs is going to be looking for extra services, and you're trying to do this, manage all this on your own. It's a really difficult situation, and most women, and it references it in the article. People are resorting to using antidepressants, you know, their own mental health, their own physical health is happening. You know, I've spoken to, I'm just thinking of a woman I know as well. Her son Reese died last year, but she was a carer for him for 14 years of his life. And during that time, her back ended up really bad because of trying to lift him without the services. Now, she's chronically ill herself. She's in mid-50s and chronically ill. These are the impacts that you have on women. And not only that, you're also talking about long-term not having pensions. You know, so it's impacting life. The child has rights themselves, but the mother trying to do it on her own.
Yeah,
it's an impossible situation.
It's breaking a lot of people.
Breaking. And while I said, you know, I'm really conscious like that I'm saying to people who are paying USE and maybe struggling that we shouldn't be cutting it. But I'm thinking of those really hard cases, and to take money that should be put into those type of services just seems wrong to me.
OK, so Louise Byrne, obviously, there are stories like this all the time. There's never enough for everything. But is the government feels that it needs to give people something back in this budget tax rise?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of remarkable that when you hear stories like that, like the Department of Health and Stephen Donnelly and the government will say time and time again that it's not a funding issue when it comes to things like healthcare, when it comes to things like disability, that it's, you know, that they can't get the staff, that the money is there and they can't get staff. And I think that has to open a broader conversation about the working conditions that you're giving these people and the kind of the way that we're looking at the health system. But I think that's one argument. But I think when it comes to the tax thing, they are very conscious that there is an election next year. They are very conscious, or next year or the year after, they're very conscious that there was a commitment in the programme to governments to change the tax bans. Now, I don't know how popular USC cuts are going to be with Fine Gael. We all know that the three Fine Gael junior ministers wrote an article back, I think it was in May or June, calling for €1,000 tax cuts. And Micheál Martin at that time came out very strongly and said, well, Fianna Fáil actually want to help those on the lower incomes. That's what USC would do. That is what a tax cut on USC would do.
And the view would be that what they did last year, which was moving the bans and the rates, that it helped
Middle Ireland, Middle Ireland, which would be, I suppose you could say, Fine Gael's base, and that's who they want to help. You know, it all comes back to the people who get up early in the morning.
Okay, and Fianna Fáil are positioning themselves more as the more social democratic than Fine Gael.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the point
that
Micheál Martin was really driving home. I remember we were up at an event with him in Cavan. I remember really well, we were standing on the playground of a school and he was saying, you know, Fianna Fáil want to help the lower income people. So that seems to be what they're going afterwards. And I suppose suppose we are a year and a half out from an election, and they are trying to distinguish themselves from Fine Gael in any way that they possibly can. And that's why I think perhaps it makes sense for Fianna Fáil to be going after the USD, that they want to help those on lower incomes to try get a bit of that voter base back, particularly from Sinn Féin, who seem to have kind of capitalised on that, those people who feel disenfranchised with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. And I think it makes sense that they are going after USD cuts as part of this budget.
Okay. Sarah Carey, you would have a genetic understanding of Fine Gael. Are they sort of doubling down on Middle Ireland and on maybe the slightly better off coping classes?
They seem to me, but I think they're wrong. Because even Gerard Brady, who also spoke at that conference that Louise and I were at on Thursday from IBEC, was saying, all the data shows that people are in jobs, they've got good incomes. Medium incomes have risen more than in other countries. Lower incomes have accelerated far higher in Ireland than in other countries. And what frustrates them is not their individual material well-being, but services, infrastructure, transport, the health system. And the consistent message from people who have good incomes, from people on median incomes and low incomes, is give us the services. So I think this trying to appeal to this, you know, well-off constituency, and if they get a grand or 1,500 quid extra in the budget in a year, is not going to deliver votes. It's actually not what people want. Presumably, they must have done some research.
It's not what people say they want.
Yeah, well, look, well, that's the consistent message. And if you've even got people like IBEC saying, you know, it's services that people want, not extra money in the budget. And just one more point.
Yeah.
Going to the single parents, that was also raised at the same conference. And Teresa Kilty from the St. Vincent de Paul was making the point there. The best way to lift a single parent out of poverty is if that mother or father can get a job, but they can't get a job unless they've got access to childcare. So again, if you give them an extra 10 or 20 quid in child benefit, does that help them get childcare or a job? No. If you had a voucher system or subsidies to community creches, that would help them get a job.
Can I just say something, yeah, though? One of the things, yeah, that Tricia Keelty did do a report, and she looked at, as part of the Society of Vincent de Paul, she did this report, and it was to look at the changes that period for lone parents who were working, that was introduced in Budget 2012 by Joan Burton. And it showed that working lone parents' poverty doubled between 2015 and 2019. And that was a direct result of the changes brought in. So, and even the Indicom report then that was brought out in 2019 that evaluated those, that research, said that working lone parents sometimes are not better off financially by working, but it could be good for their mental health. Now, there is no other group in the society where you say you're not better off working, but do it for your mental health. So working lone parents do not get the support they need.
Is
there who?
Yeah, married women with young children.
Absolutely, you're right.
I think the vast majority of married women with young children, yeah, I know, are continuing working in order to keep a career.
You're absolutely right. And they're doing that for pension entitlement.
Or you could
call
it maybe the man in the house. But you're right.
And that's all to do with childcare as well.
Yeah, and look, it does seem, in fairness to the government, that what they are doing is they really are doubling down on the childcare thing. And they did do a substantial cut in it last year. And they, according to the Business Post, they're doing it again. Dan, can we, if we zone out again for a minute, right? So we're back to a very old, simple argument here of like, do you give people back money or do you take more of their money and give everybody better services, right? Is it that simple though? Like, okay, Department of Health, 2 billion over budget again this year, on having already absorbed all the extra money they were given during COVID, which, you know, seems to have been calcified into the system as permanent. Does taking more tax money and pushing it back into the system automatically mean that we are getting better services? I think a lot of people might question that.
Well, clearly there are big questions around that, you know, in terms of Ireland's healthcare system. It ranks it right the middle of European healthcare systems in terms of its outcomes, in terms of how well we do with it. But spending per head is unusually high. So we're clearly not getting the outcomes relative to the inputs we're getting from in healthcare, and we could talk about different areas of the public sector as well.
Give me another example.
well, where are the big areas of expenditure are, you know,
education,
infrastructure, education, welfare, and
housing.
Housing now has become a very big, the government's become very involved in that area. So, you know, does it make sense for government and housing authority bodies to be spending money buying existing houses and paying higher prices for them? That's not adding to the housing stock. That's simply taking housing from one group in society, giving it to another. So, you know, there's all sorts of debate. But this is the meat and potatoes of sort of policy analysis is, you know, what's better way, how's the best way to get bang for buck from money that's spent? And from a political perspective, it's, you know, do you have higher taxes and more services, or do you have lower taxes and let people provide for themselves? That's sort of meat and potatoes.
Are we a relatively highly taxed country for the services we get, do you know?
Again, it's always difficult to measure it because we have this problem with our GDP and the standard way of measuring an economy is GDP, and ours is inflated. So in terms of how heavily we taxed, we are on a personal level, you alluded to it earlier on, that from middle to higher taxation levels on a personal basis, we tend to be at the higher end, the Northern European end. On low incomes and below average, we tax less in personal taxation. Sarah mentioned this earlier on. One of the reasons we have low inequality in Ireland and our inequality hasn't risen as it's happened in some other countries is because we have an unusual tax system. It's the most progressive in the OECD, which means lower paid people pay less tax than compared to most other countries. Higher people pay more tax.
Mm-hmm. And they'll be the lower paid will be paying even less if we cut the USC. Yeah. Cutting the USC, as Daft says, Brian, it's the only universal tax that cannot be avoided. It should be increased to 10% or even 15% applied to all incomes, passive and active, would act as a floor contribution from absolutely everyone. Then income taxes should be adjusted to exclude lower incomes completely. I'm a single income person with a daughter just finished college. I'm on a decent salary. I'm living month to month. My taxes are too high. The USC is a joke. I'd love to see it reduced. Someone else says, at long last, someone is talking about services. I think we talk a lot about services. That's all we want. Decent hospitals, bus system, etc. Now, there is, Louise, another aspect to all of this, which is the front of the Sunday Independent today. Coalition in discussions over asking revenue to collect the new media levy at Hugh O'Connell. And this is more further fallout from the RTE saga.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable we're talking about cutting taxes in one way and perhaps bringing in a new tax in another, and it'd be a very brave government that I think would bring in this kind of universal media levy. But
they do seem to be making noises that they want to change it, yeah?
Yeah, well, I think the kind of the reform of the TV licence fee has been a topic of discussion for a long time now. There's been widespread, I suppose, criticism of the arguments both in favour and against of revenue collecting this fee. Revenue in the past, the idea of them collecting it has been completely vetoed, saying that it wouldn't work. And I suppose the scandal in RTE and the kind of the drop off in the TV licence fee revenue has thrust this back into the spotlight again. So Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Independent today reporting that a new universal media levy that could be cheaper than the TV licence fee, which I suppose is perhaps one positive of it,
I suppose, if everyone is being compelled to pay it.
Exactly, if everyone's being compelled to pay it, and I think Micheál Martin's quoted in the piece saying, well, you know, if everyone was compelled to pay it, well then naturally you'd have a higher income from it, so it could be lower.
And the money would not all go to RTE either, it should be made clear. The money is for
every media, which I think would be very welcomed across the board. But I think it's a really interesting conversation that you would collect revenue, would collect the levy from the state's 2.1 million households, especially when it is kind of an idea that has been so widely criticised in the past. And I think there is an acceptance in government that they're going to have to do something, because I think the situation in RTE as it currently is, it can't be allowed to continue. We've seen a drop off in the TV licence fee. We know Cabinet was told this week that by the end of the year, RTE are predicting losses in the TV licence of 21 million euro. That's on top of a request for interim funding of 34.5 billion euro. I think everyone in Cabinet can accept that you can't just hand RTE 55 million euro
but
at the moment,
Sarah,
and it wouldn't go down very well in the public.
Yeah, okay. Will it be like water charges though if they suddenly turn around and say, and particularly given the you know, the, everything that's come out over the summer, to turn around to every household and say, okay, we're now going to the tax man's going to be collecting off.
Yeah, but you know
money
what?
That people will see effectively as money for RTE.
Yeah, but I think what we should all remember as well is the property tax, which Revenue is very efficiently collecting. And that's why they want Revenue to do this, because they're so good at it. And I think if people see the reform, so John Lee in the Mail is covering this, their front page story, Cabinet want cuts to RTE pay and staff. And he says the big ask that people are looking for is to sell Montrose. So this campus that we're on here right now. One idea that I've seen floated that I think is a really good idea is the post corporate people have vacated the GPO and moved down to a new headquarters in the IFSC, and RTE started out in the GPO. So if you put a studio, radio and TV studios there in the GPO in the centre of town, so you could get politicians, business people, journalists, all the people that you need for your programmes, sell Montrose and get a cheaper site further out of town for the wider staff. If you give up something like that, then maybe that creates the political consensus then to have the media charge. And I have paid the TV licence, and I really, really do support it, because I've worked in commercial radio, OK? I worked in News Talk. I know what it's like. It's no fun, OK? You do need properly funded media, provided, of course, that that fund goes to programme makers and not into profits or pensions or very high salaries. You know, so people, if they're assured that the money will go to the right place, I think a consensus could be built around it.
OK. And look, I'm sure people working in News Talk would say that they're doing fine, and that they're making excellent programming there. And I'm sure.
Well, but that's my point. But on a shoestring, Brendan, and I would love to see those people and in local radio stations all around the country who are being paid buttons. If they got a cut of it and were paid a decent salary to keep making the programmes that they're making and make even better ones, better funded, then you could build consensus around this payment.
OK. Anyone else on that before we leave it? Louise, you're looking unmoved by it.
No, I have a thing about the TV licence, and just for the record, I have my TV licence paid. But it's the one thing that a lot of lone parents end up in jail for, where they get fined for not having a TV licence when they're on social welfare.
And do they actually end up
they
in
do.
Jail?
They do. I've heard
it's
so
very
many cases.
Small numbers.
No, it's not that small. And I'll tell you what exactly happens. I'll do a comparison for you. So, for instance, lone parents are one of the only groups on long-term social welfare who do not get access to the household benefits package that gives you the TV licence. That's why you only hear about lone parents in jail for the TV licence.
Okay. And look, we don't have it. You don't have figures, or I don't have figures.
Well, I know that... you're right.
How many end
But what I will say is that there are lone parents who end up in Mountjoy. They get arrested when they can't afford the fine. I mean, if they couldn't afford the TV licence, they can't afford the fine. They get brought down to Mountjoy. Now, I've heard people talking and they say, oh, it's only 3 hours, it's grand, and then it's only on the second time you get fined. But what my point about that would be, I find that really annoying, because there are those women who are in jail for not having a TV licence can sometimes be owed thousands and tens of thousands in back child maintenance. And if you compare...
Okay. Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien, Sarah Carey and Louise Byrne staying with us. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien, Sarah Carey and Louise Byrne still with us. Dan, will you kick us off on the national question against the background of the Wolf Tones? You picked two pieces, Declan Lynch in the Sunday Independent and a very trenchant piece by Ger Collar in the Mail on Sunday, Varadkar Dices with Landmines in Ireland's Fourth Greenfield.
Yeah, so Declan Lynch is not a fan of nationalism of any variety, and says that Brexit and what's happened around it in Britain has led Britain into great difficulties, and warns that going down a nationalistic route in this country would not be would risk going the same way. And Ger Collar is of the view that the Taoiseach raising the issue of the unification of the country within his lifetime again is not helpful for anything really.
And why is it not helpful? We need to talk about these things, don't we?
Yeah, well, he just feels that with so many things going on at the moment that, you know, it's a kind of, it's a provocative kind of thing rather than a constructive kind of thing. That's Ger Collar's view.
Yeah. So the Taoiseach did it in the context of Brian Dobson asked him about the Wolf Tones, and the Taoiseach then seemed to kind of quite deliberately, didn't he, Louise? say.
I think that's fair to say. It was very unprompted. I suppose he was kind of, Brian Dobson put it, are you going to go to the Wolftones concert in the Three Arena? And Leo Varadkar goes, why'd you ask me that? And it kind of, suppose, we got into that conversation about the Ooh Ah Up the Raw chance at Electric Picnic last weekend. And I suppose Leo Varadkar, completely unprompted, as often some of the stuff he says is, said, you know, I can see unification in this country in my lifetime, and I think we have to be conscious on all sides. Oh, he said it many times before. Yeah. Like, it didn't really come as a surprise to anyone. I don't think that he said it. He said it many times. But I think he kind of said it in the context of, we need to be kind of perhaps mindful of what we're saying to people, that he actually said he was of the opinion, and I would actually tend to agree with him in this instance, that perhaps that, you know, all the conuments and the pearl clutching that's gone on this week in relation to the Electric Picnic and the Wolftones, that it's perhaps not as political as people may think it is, but that we do at the same time have to be conscious of what we're saying if we are to have a united Ireland in the next, he said, in his lifetime. We'll be kind and say he's maybe another 40 years in, half a decade.
Yeah, Ger Colleran wasn't giving him quite that much. He was saying, I think 82, he was predicting average death in Ireland, so 38 years, yeah. Sarah, you were at the Wolftones. I mean, Taoiseach Bertie Ahern as well, both kind of, Bertie Ahern's line was, look, if you tell young people not to do something, they're going to do it, like,
yeah, so like, this is the
in
tactical.
A way, I kind of wonder, is it not just like a meme or something at this stage? It has no meaning for them. It's a thing they do, like.
That's the whole point, that it has no meaning for them. There's no other group of victims in this society that you could mock via a song and a chorus. But they think that it has no meaning. So Tim Parry was supposed to turn 43 on the 1st of September, but he was blown to bits by an IRA bomb in Warrington 30 years ago. So with regard to that argument about the tactics, that if you make a fuss about it, Joe Duffy's just helping them make a fuss about it. I'm helping them, the Wolftones, by making a fuss about it. There are two arguments against that. One is the moral imperative and the other is the teachable moment. When people are being mocked, when victims are being mocked and bullied, okay, let me finish. No, Brendan.
Wait a second.
There's a moral imperative.
Wait a second. Were they mocking victims? You were there.
I was there
at the Wolftones. Were those young people mocking victims?
If you're singing joyously and exuberantly, up the Ra. If you're Colin Parry, Tim Parry's father, or the family of Joanne Mathers, the woman who was killed for collecting the census, or, you know, all those victims in the North, and the IRA, remember, killed more Catholics, as if that should make any difference. Of course it's being mocked. So how are you supposed to feel? And the second is the teachable moment. So, you know, when my kids were younger, and if they came home from school and there were jokes being made about gay people or something like that, you don't say, well, I'm not going to tell them not to do it because that'll just make them do it even more. You seize that as an opportunity to educate them as to why it's wrong. So that's why you do it. And you don't sit back and let them do it.
Okay. I think you're insulting young people's intelligence, though, a little bit. Like, I think people are well aware, and I don't think anyone would say that it's what the IRA and or the other side, for that matter.
Are they well aware, Louise?
I think they are. Like, I think everyone is well aware. And I think if you had a situation where you had a group of people standing on the streets screaming up the row, or, you know, or outside a hospital where someone had been injured by a provisional IRA, I think it's a very different conversation.
I think a lot of
people standing in a field in Electric Picnic singing along to a song, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily as deep as it is, as you're trying to say that it is. I don't think it is as
political. Well, I can tell you this. I put an article in the Irish Independent on Thursday and my phone exploded and hasn't stopped since, with people supporting my views. Absolutely.
Okay, but like, there's all the people who didn't explode your phone as well, who disagree. Fine. Like, yeah.
So we live in a time of empathy. So let's say, how would we feel about a similar thing up the UDA? If there were thousands of people in a field in Northern Ireland saying up the UDA, how would people feel about that?
Yeah, Louise, you're nodding. Louise Bayliss.
Yeah, no, I do think, I do agree with, I think I'm older, obviously, than Louise Byrne. but I remember the Oma bombing, and I remember, you know, watching children being, you know, the joy of in August going back to school and buying the school books and their school shoes. That's a hard memory for me to let go of. Now, you know, in the interest of reconciliation, I probably should try to let go of it. And, you know, but it's hard to. And to some extent, hearing, you know, hearing things like up the row, you know, we do need reconciliation, and reconciliation won't go by taunting either side. Yeah. And I know there were wrongs on both sides.
We'll come back to up the row in a minute. It's an interesting point you make. I should let it go, but you find it difficult to let it go. Does something need to happen here to allow us to move on? Does there have to be more
but
of
Brendan,
a conversation?
But Brendan, also this
just wait.
Week, yeah.
Does there need to be more of a conversation? You said reconciliation.
Yeah.
Do we need truth and reconciliation? Is there some? Are people not fessing up enough and saying yes, this happened? Is there an element of we're not having a real conversation?
Yeah, I absolutely
this?
Think that.
So you
it.
Want to let that go?
I want to let it go, but not until I hear the yes.
A process it was, you feel
a process that would be felt.
And this same week, the Conservative government has been condemned by all parties in Northern Ireland for passing a bill that would do precisely that, move on and not pursue old cases. And yet Sinn Féin, the SDLP, the UUP, everybody is saying that being told to move on is an insult. So how do you say, oh, being told to move on is an insult, and then saying, oh, up the rash, or they're only having a laugh, they don't mean it.
But I think it actually raises a lot of questions about why we're not talking about the legacy bill more. Like, this is one of the very few things that all the parties in Northern Ireland agree with, and we don't seem to be having the same level of conversation or the same level of discussion or debate down this side of the border on the legacy bill as we are about a Wolf Tone song. And I think that raises questions as well, as why are we looking at one thing and not the other?
Because the Wolf Tone song...
I don't think. I think they're being looked at in two completely separate manners, and I think the legacy bill is probably worthy of a lot more conversation and a lot more debate than people singing along to a Wolf Tone song in a field in Stradbally.
Because the people singing along reveals that memory has been lost.
I don't think it has, Sarah. Like, I think you're...
But you said yourself they don't mean it. Let Louise finish.
I didn't say they don't mean it. I just said I don't think it's as deep as you're looking at. And I think, like, I'm not out of school that long. We were told about all of this. Like, no one by saying that is saying what the IRA did was correct. And I don't think there's anyone who would agree that what the IRA did was correct.
So then singing Ooh-Ah Up the Rah, is that not...
But it's a song.
Problematic.
It's part of a song. Its song has been around for decades. I think if you were looking at it in a different circumstance, like I said, if there was people out on the street, outside Leinster House, outside Stormont, walking down the street screaming up the rah, well, then I think it would be condemned. And I think you'd be looking at it in a very different set of circumstances. But I don't think this is the same set of circumstances.
Is context important here, Dan?
Of course it is. And just Louise's point, I think the main reason we haven't been discussing the legacy bill, it's not as covered as much in the media, is because the media in the South pay very little attention to what goes on north of the border. And they're very different medias. If you want to read about the legacy bill, you read the northern papers rather than the papers down here. I think that's just a psychological thing that we have. We just don't pay that much attention to what goes on.
I think the legacy bill was very well covered on RTE all this week. I think
today,
politicians were out talking about it, and it has been in the papers a lot. We've been completely ignoring it.
But generally speaking, the interest in matters in Northern Ireland down here appears to me, I know many people who see it proudly say that they're just not interested in Northern Ireland. So there doesn't seem to be a demand down here for more understanding of what goes on in Northern Ireland politics, which says something itself, I think.
Yeah, OK, look, we're not going to fix that one here, but I think we got an interesting insight into the various sides of that there. Louise Bayliss, the Sunday Business Post. Housing crisis is the Sunday Times. Ukrainian refugees rock up for respite at festival campsite. This is Bo Donnelly, and this is about Ukrainian refugees going to stay after the electric picnic has ended in the tents down there.
Yeah, there was an article, in, as you just said there, and they're talking to actual Ukrainian refugees who are saying, oh, the tent is lovely and it's great to get this thing. And they apparently do have electricity and there's services available.
There are pathways down to bathrooms, laundry facilities. Three meals a day, a recreation area with games and TV. There is Wi-Fi and there's 24-hour security.
Yeah, at the same time, they're living in tents.
I'm not saying I want to go and live there. But
yeah, exactly. And they are living in tents. And I don't know if that's a wider message to that the government has given to Ukrainians, that you're not going to get the special treatment you are getting. But from the point of view that women and children who have been traumatised in Ukraine are coming over and we're housing them in bell tents in a field away from services.
Do we have anywhere else?
No, Brendan. And I remember I was on your show around this time last year and I was very sympathetic to the Department of Integration when they were trying to deal with this crisis. And it is a major crisis. And, you know, this time last year we had the same issue where people, student accommodation were being reclaimed back by the universities, and where did you put Ukrainian families? So we had this a year ago and I was absolutely sympathetic that, you know, the government were put in an awful position. It's a year on, we've known this has been coming, and to come up with a solution of putting tents in. The weather's beautiful out there today and hopefully will, but within another month we know the weather could get very cold. Okay. And I just say Stradbally, does it have the services to facilitate 750 children potentially going to schools, services, GPs, facilities, childcare, all of those facilities? Do they have that? And if they don't, what's going to happen to those people in the tents? And again, the 6 weeks, will it be 6 weeks?
Okay, Louise Byrne, you picked Maya Dunphy's piece on this in Sunday Independent.
Yeah, and she was kind of making actually a lot of the same points that Louise is making. She was saying, you know, what was put in place in Stradbally for Electric Picnic, it was for those couple of days. It was never meant for 6 weeks of people. And she was questioning, you know, where do these people go? And she seems we've learned nothing from the pop-up accommodation, the hotel lobbies, sleeping on airport floors. And she was saying that the fact that the government don't know what they're going to do with these people in 6 weeks' time, it's nothing short of irresponsible. It's like giving someone a dinghy knowing it has a slow leak, or inviting people for lunch when your fridge is empty. And I think in a way, a lot of people kind of can't fathom the fact that we're so far into this crisis, 18 months, and the government is still kind of struggling to find places for these people to live. And we know it's 6 weeks.
100,000 people is a lot of people to arrive in.
It's a huge amount.
2% of the population.
It's a huge amount of people, and it has increased over the last couple of months. But I mean, it's in line with what projections that they thought they were going to have this time last year. So I mean, it's been coming actually a lot slower in some ways than they might have expected. And I mean, it's 6 weeks on this campsite, and it's grand now. The weather is good. It's fine for now, but where are these people going to be moved in 6 weeks' time? Is it going to be another campsite? Where are the people coming in 6 weeks' time? Where are they going to go
Sarah Carey?
When it's getting a bit colder?
But where else are they going to go? We have run out of space. There's just nowhere else for them to go. So I know it's not ideal. I know it's not great. There are refugees all around the world living in horrific conditions. And if this fills a gap, and gets us over particularly that hump with the 3,000 student accommodation places, you know, having to be reclaimed, what else can they do? So when someone comes up with a better idea, I'm willing to listen to it. But right now, there's 500 people coming in a week. Where else are they going to go?
Yeah, I suppose the argument that the two Louises are making is that they had time to come up with
But sure, you've seen all year the efforts that they're making, you know, redoing up empty hotels, housing, army barracks, every single bed in the country that they're trying. They're paying what people, what, 400, 800 euros
800.
A month, is it, to take people? Like, is there anything that they haven't done? If they haven't done something that they should be doing, tell me about it.
But a lot of it seems to be stopgap solutions rather than longer term solutions. It seems to be being reactive rather than proactive. And like, I had a story, I first looked at it last January, where the Department of Integration had bought a load of houses with the intention of doing them up. And every time, I think they'd bought 34, every time I've asked since, there's only still one in use. So why are things like that not being fast tracked to get these people into accommodation that is more suitable in the long run?
Okay, I need to take a break. Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien, Sarah Carey and Louise Byrne staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Louise Bayliss, Dan O'Brien, Sarah Carey and Louise Byrne still with us. And now we're in the sprint to the end, Dan. So it's a bit unfair for me to say to you, please explain to us, because I think most people are probably slightly unaware of it, but the Digital Services Bill, as it's called, which Adrian Reckler is writing about today, it is going to affect us as punters, like stuff like the Apple's walled garden and all that is going to be disrupted, yeah?
Americans innovate. Chinese imitate, Europeans regulate. So that's what we've been saying for decades.
I love it.
Not so true now. But Adrian Weckler has an excellent piece on what the European Union is doing to regulate the tech industry. There are two big issues, the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act. The Digital Markets Act is what he's talking about today. The most important part, from my view, of this is that it will stop the iPhone, the Android devices from keeping out, from making their app store, having too much control over their app stores. So it'll basically break open those sort of semi-monopoly.
So if you're an Apple person stuck in the Apple world, as a lot of people are, that's not going to be the case anymore.
Exactly. That's the purpose of this bill. It also means that, for example, you can, if you're not on WhatsApp, you can send a WhatsApp message, or you can send an iMessage to a WhatsApp user. So it'll make it easier to use things, and it'll break down barriers between platforms, because the EU, quite correctly, largely in my view, views these platforms now as being so important that they're effectively utilities and they need to be treated slightly different.
Okay, so Europe are actually leading the charge here in breaking these monopolies, yeah?
In Europe has, that's the thing I mentioned at the beginning, you know, Europe has, in a whole range of areas, has been more inclined, something like chemicals, for example, like the chemicals directive. So Europe has been a sort of global leader in regulation. And as Adrian makes the point here, absolutely correctly, it may be, as often happens, that other countries, including the US, will follow the regulatory lead of Europe.
So are governments finally going to take back power from the tech companies? Because I think most people feel at the moment that tech companies are probably more powerful than governments.
Well, how dramatic this will be. I certainly think it is a significant, these two pieces of legislation at EU level will be significant in terms of doing what they're going to do. Is there going to be some sort of complete, reining in of these huge companies? No.
But I will be able to send a WhatsApp to as an iMessage. Excellent. Sarah, The Sunday Business Post, Mary McKeown's piece today, is a person we might have forgotten about, and that's the point here, Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
there's a bit of a panic going on around her.
So Joe Biden has done a great job as president. First of all, he beat Trump. He did really well in holding Congress during the midterm elections, and some of the economic things he's done have been absolutely fantastic. But he's old, and it's causing an awful lot of people an awful lot of worry. So who is going to be his running mate? So Marion's piece is about a debate within the Democratic Party, this panic-stricken attempt to try and reboot the reputation of
because
Kamala Harris.
Because you need a viable person there behind him to
exactly.
take over.
Is exactly. Yeah. So do they try and do something with her? But she just, it's amazing how she just fell flat. Now, she mentions in her piece that's because the presidency unfairly gave her responsibility for immigration, so the Republicans were able to attack her on that. And obviously it's a very polarising issue. And then she also brings in, could there be a case where maybe they would persuade her to opt out of being his running mate and get in somebody that might have more traction, like Gavin Newsom.
I think they
the
feel
governor.
That ship has sailed now.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Get California or Gretchen Whitmer. And Larry Donnelly was telling me at the New Ross Kennedy Summer School last weekend, he felt that Gretchen might be a good run. But anyway, what are they going to do with Kamala? Can they make her more popular, or do they ditch
okay,
her?
And she's it now. Is she, that's it. Like, it's too late to do anything about it.
I wouldn't say that. Okay. No, I wouldn't say that. But they either try and make her popular or they ditch her. So that's their problem. But I wouldn't say it's too late at all. There's a lot to play for yet, I think.
Yeah. This is actually, Dan, quite an important election coming up in America for us. And we're kind of semi-ignoring it so far. But, like, this is the future of a lot of stuff here at stake.
To put it mildly, a second Trump presidency for Europe when Europe is at war. Europe, there's panic going on in Europe around this now, and people are more and more starting to think about it. But to some extent, there's been denial about it because we've got plenty of problems. But a second Trump term, if Europe is still at war, is going to lead to huge uncertainty,
okay,
at least.
On that cheery note, we leave it at Louise Bayliss, founder of Spark and campaign coordinator with Focus Ireland, Dan O'Brien, chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs, Sarah Carey, communications consultant and columnist with the Irish Independent, and Louise Byrne, political correspondent at the Irish Mirror. Thank you all very much. That was an excellent hour, I feel, if we say so ourselves. Well done, guys. And now it's just...